Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm and you're listening to another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest this time is renowned British sailing journalist from sailjuice.com, Andy Rice. Andy, how's lockdown treating you? How's the lockdown lifestyle going for you?
Hello, Justin. I can say good morning because we're both in roughly the we're in the same continent, aren't we?
Well, we are.
And I have barely been out of Hampshire since October, and so yeah, compared with life over the last 10, 15, 20 years of travelling on average at least once a month to somewhere in the world, it's been a pretty strange year, and. I've adapted and managed to find a way of earning a living away from the traveling. But yeah, it's not been the most enjoyable of times in the UK. But you know, I think probably pretty much everyone listening to this podcast has got their own little violin to play for their own lives. So making the best of it and still enjoying life.
And Andy, do you think, like a lot of other industries where people have been working from home and working remotely, do you think what we do as sailing journalists is going to be impacted by this? Do you think we're going to be doing more stuff on Zoom, or can we get back, once this is all finally over, we can get back to being at the events?
I think what we're seeing across so many industries is an acceleration of a number of trends that COVID has now brought to the fore much, much more quickly. Obviously, online shopping has been accelerated, and Jeff Bezos has become massively wealthier during COVID, thanks to everyone ordering off Amazon and shops closing. And for us, you could see, for example, with the live commentary for SailGP being based in London, even when there was an event going on in Sydney, that sometimes we don't necessarily have to be on site to do some of the jobs that we do. Obviously, that doesn't apply to a photographer or someone holding a TV camera. But I fear that for us, maybe it's getting a little bit harder to justify us traveling around the world. There was already the Greta Thunberg effect to think about, and the fact that we were starting to ask ourselves harder questions about whether travel was justified in the way that it has been on environmental grounds. And now we've got a further reason with COVID for us not to travel. So all those things, I think when we come out of this, some things will have changed, and maybe one of those things is that we are traveling less than we used to.
Yeah, that's going to be a bit of a pity for us, because other than the masses of money that we make from our sport, you know, we don't really do it just for the money, do we? We do it for the lifestyle and the pleasure of visiting these places. So that could be a little bit tough for us.
A bit doom and gloom, and we don't want to dwell there too much. But you asked me a question, so I'm afraid I gave you that answer.
You did. Now, Andy, back in the day, we used to regularly catch up once a week on a podcast called Sailing Talk, and we used to chat through what we thought were the most interesting things that had happened in the sailing world. I'm blowing our own trumpets a little bit here, but we were kind of ahead of the game somewhat. So it's nice to be able to catch up with you once again and do just that. I just wanted to have a chat through with you what was going on. There's plenty going on right now, and there's some interesting stuff that I want to talk to you about that you've been developing as well. We'll do that towards the end of the podcast. But obviously, the two big things, the Vendée Globe and the America's Cup, have you been following along with those?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I've been taking a pretty reasonable interest in both, but not following it blow by blow or doing the virtual regatta around the world. I haven't had time for that. And I spend enough time in front of a computer to want to play a video game on the same computer. But the Vendée obviously has been the most exciting that we've ever seen, for reasons that I don't think we could have predicted. It's just after that finish in the Volvo Ocean Race 3 years ago, where we didn't know which of three boats was going to win the overall race with only about 20 minutes to run to the final finish line in The Hague. Could we have imagined that the Vendée Globe could deliver anything similar to that? Well, it sort of did. Because every Vendée Globe that I can remember, the ones that I've personally been involved with, but the ones that I followed from a distance, generally, we, bar disaster, we've known who the winner is going to be from quite a long way out, and that was never the case this time.
It wasn't, and that got us over that kind of terrible inertia that happens with long offshore races. The Volvo Ocean Race used to suffer from it. The Vendée certainly suffered from it, where everybody watches the start, everybody watches the first few weeks, and then suddenly there's this like, oh wow, are those guys still going? And you know, people are definitely, it tails off in the middle of the race, and then people get more excited and engaged again at the end. But this one, and I've been guilty of that too, this one I was literally glued to it week by week. And we ran Conrad Coleman and myself did a weekly podcast just as an update for people who hadn't been able to follow it, maybe day by day. And every week we said, wow, what another thrilling week in the Vendée Globe, because Fantastic. It was so close.
Yeah. Yeah, quite incredible. And of course, as we're talking, there's still a good number to finish. So we don't know what the final attrition rate is going to be. But it seems like more are going to get round as a proportion of the overall fleet than we've seen before. Am I right in thinking?
Oh, yeah. I think it's dramatically, the attrition rate is down dramatically, despite losing, you know, some of the stars of the race, the hotly tipped podium contenders like Alex Thompson and Jeremy Bayou, and even Kevin Escoffier. And more people are going to get round this time, and we'll just touch wood for the skippers who are still out there sailing, because as we've seen, it's not a guarantee. Even in the last 90 miles, we saw Boris Herman run himself into a fishing boat. So this is still a very tough race, and we shouldn't take it for granted. But yeah, I think for me, Andy, the characters that this race created this time, we had even more characters than normal to focus on, and some of them were people we just weren't expecting. And I'll be honest with you, I hadn't really any knowledge of who were contenders, including Yannick Bestervan, who I knew his name, but I certainly didn't have him down as a hot tip for winning this race.
No, absolutely. And I'm really pleased for Yannick that he did end up winning, because coming around Cape Horn, having done such a good job in the Southern Ocean, seemed he ran into a brick wall in the South Atlantic that pretty much restarted the race. And he picked the wrong side of trying to get past that wall, and then found himself in a battle that he probably never thought he was going to win until fairly late on, or at least from what I was following, his name wasn't coming up a lot in conversation as the possible winner until quite late on, I thought.
Yeah, and he made some interesting comments about the size of the foils, because, you know, we'd seen the new boats with these gigantic foils that were expected to just rip away through the Southern Ocean and disappear literally over the horizon. And leave everybody behind. But I mean, that really didn't happen. And he said he was very happy with his smaller foils on his older boat, because he was just felt like he was more efficient. And when it got so windy that the foils were a hindrance, he was able to get rid of more of his foils than the others could. Plus, we saw damage to the foils on the other boats. And I guess that's an interesting one, isn't it? This problem of our ocean race course is really being littered with, I don't know, what are they hitting down there, Andy? Containers maybe, or big fish, whales? What is it? It seems to be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's most likely containers, isn't it? And then striking fish as well, which I understand this bit of technology called Oscar is meant to deal with. So it seems to me like there should be a complete rethink about the way that these boats are designed for what could happen, rather than what they're hoping doesn't happen. Because it seems to me that the newest designs were designed as an all-out fastest machine, if everything goes okay and you keep your fingers crossed and everything works out for you. But when things go wrong and you break a foil, or you break a rudder, then in what kind of position are you to be able to continue the race? And I just wonder if the let's call them the semi-foilers of, or the quarter-foilers of last time round, when Armel Lecléache won the race and still holds the record for fastest round in the Vendée Globe. I wonder if those sort of halfway house foilers are actually the more sensible way to go, bearing in mind we saw Jean Le Cam still do extremely well in this race with an old school straight up and down foil design. So I wonder if the foils have got a little bit too greedy, bearing in mind how much debris there is in the oceans and the fact that you have a high chance of hitting some of that stuff on the way round.
Yeah, I think there's going to be some head scratching. There's going to be some difficult phone calls with designers who are going to, I don't know, maybe they're not going to have a difficult conversation, but, you know, they clearly have gone down this path of just bigger and more powerful boats, and they seem to have disregarded the risks that we've just been talking about of hitting stuff or just destroying your boat because the boats were too powerful. Because that was the big chat before the race started, was how the skippers were going to be able to manage the power on these boats. And we only lost one mast on the race so far. I'm touching wood again. Because of what I was being told by smart people who know is that the foils were so powerful that the mast became the fuse. So if you weren't on top of managing the loads on the boat, you could easily just pull the mast out of the boat, just snap it from too much power. And we only saw that with one boat.
So the masts are built to a one design rule, as I understand it. So they have now become the weak point in the system with these latest generation foilers. So I think you're absolutely right about that. So the sailors have either done a good job of managing that, or they just haven't had the conditions. I mean, maybe it's partly the fact that they didn't have that many full-on conditions through the Southern Ocean, for example, or not traditional run through the Southern Ocean that is a lot more flat out than what we saw this time round. But I do think that maybe the boats should be able to sail at a pretty good lick without the foils, rather than being foil dependent. And I remember one of the skippers, I don't know who it was, maybe it was Boris Herman, saying he was sort of treating his foils as a bonus when he got to use them, as opposed to an essential. And that seems to me to be a good way of thinking about the foils. They're a nice to have rather than an intrinsic part of the boat for this kind of race around the world with all the debris that we're talking about. But I don't want to bag the Amokas too much, because I just think we're so fortunate as a sport to have the Amokas and to have people brave enough to sail these boats around the planet. And there's so much good trickle down of technology from what we're seeing. You've got to push the envelope too far, and I think we've seen that this time, maybe particularly with Kevin Escoffier's boat. But you've got to push those envelopes to actually find out where the sensible places are.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it'll be interesting to see what comes out of it. It'll be interesting to see what the knock-on effect is for the ocean race, which is going to feature a fully crewed Imoca 60 style boat. I have a question for you, Andy, actually, on that topic. So I think the quality of the video coming off the boats has been pretty interesting during this last Vendée Globe. It's been great to get inside the heads of some of the skippers, and I think they've been very open and honest, the ones that I've followed, and it's always interesting to see that. But because the boats are so enclosed, I just wonder, are we missing out on the on-deck action that we're kind of used to with the ocean race? I mean, Boris Herman went around the world. Part of the time, he was wearing his Christmas sweater, and, you know, he's so cool, calm, and collected. He looked like he was kind of sitting in some German bar. He could easily have been sipping a beer as he talked us through what was going on outside the window. You almost wouldn't know he was on a boat. And is this going to play well with the ocean race, where we've got an onboard reporter trying to make stories and make interesting content?
I think it's a massive problem. I know that the sort of decision to put Imoca 60s in what was then the Volvo Ocean Race came along some time ago, and it was one of Mark Turner's ideas. But after the 2018 finish and those three Volvo 65s finishing within 20 minutes of each other, I thought that delivered the most excitement that we could ever see. And the sailors don't like the Volvo 65s. They're horrible to sail, from what we're told. But you and I, or maybe you know, because you've probably been on them a bit, but you and I don't really know that. And certainly the general public don't know or don't care. But what they will marvel at is the fire hose of water going through the cockpits, to the point of being maybe ridiculous at times. I think the 70s and the 65s were a little bit too much in that direction and maybe dangerous because of that. But in terms of what the photographers and the videographers want out of spectacular images and man against the elements, then I think the Volvo 65s have totally got it over the Imoca 60s, because the Imoca 60s are just too efficient for their own good, I think.
Yeah, and that's going to be an interesting conversation that the teams have with potential sponsors. And I think they have to be honest with this situation, because you're right, the 65s will be pumping out the same content that we know. You know, we know what that content is like. We know how good it can be, and we know how compelling it is. But it's unproven on the 60s. So yeah, going to be interesting to watch how that develops. Andy, let's move on to the America's Cup. It's 3 o'clock in the morning where I'm living here in Spain. It's what, 2 o'clock in the morning for you when these races are on? You got out of bed and watched them, right?
I must admit, I did my best not to open my email or do anything that might prejudice or might show me the big reveal beforehand, and then I try and watch them on YouTube before I actually know what the outcome's going to be.
In the morning after?
Yes, exactly.
You've changed, Andy.
I know. Yes, it's a pretty sad state of affairs, isn't it? But I thought with the passing of Larry Ellison's huge input of funds and the vision of Russell Coutts for what we've seen over the previous 10 years of the America's Cup, I thought we were going to lose something in the TV coverage, and I've been pleasantly proven wrong. It's at least as good as Bermuda 2017 and possibly better from a technical point of view. And I think the boats are, I thought the AC50s from 2017 were pretty exciting, and I thought they were amazing. But I think these AC75s are just incredible to watch. So I've really been enjoying what I've been watching.
Yeah, I agree. I think the TV coverage, I mean, there was one shot in that race between the Brits and the Italians, that race that everybody's talking about, where the boats went round the top mark, you know, a second apart, the final windward gate, and the whoever was directing, and I know our good friend Leon Sefton is heavily involved in this, it could well have been him, but the shot was straight across the gate so that you saw the bow of the first boat in the foreground come round the mark and go around, and then literally at the other gate, the Italians came flying in as well, and you just got this sense of, oh, there really is nothing between these boats now for this final downwind leg. It's tremendously exciting.
Well, you make a really good point about the TV coverage, actually, because I've just realised after what you've said that I haven't actually once been shouting at the TV screen saying, pull out or go to the other boat or whatever, which I can remember from watching previous America's Cups, where it's quite clear that they parachuted in some fantastic sports director from American football that doesn't know one end of a boat from another. And it's one of those things, you don't notice the good stuff, you just notice when it's bad. And I haven't had any complaints about what I've been watching. I think they've been right on the money with what we've been watching, and they brought in the right camera angles at the right time.
Yeah, nice job as well by Kenny Reed and Nathan Outridge in the commentary box. And I can't remember the name of the Kiwi straight man, let's call him, who ties it all together. But I think he's done a pretty good job of of dealing with those two. Nathan in particular, I think, is a real find, isn't he? He's got some great, we know he's got great insight, but he's a great communicator.
He is a great communicator. He doesn't leave much room for us to operate, does he?
Because he doesn't.
He actually knows what he's talking about, and he also puts it extremely eloquently. And you can see that he's thinking his way round the racetrack as one of those sailors. And his calls are very prescient. He normally knows what's going to happen 30 seconds before it does happen. And I just sit there, and every time I sit there listening to Nathan, I'm thinking, why isn't this guy racing on one of these boats? That is the elephant in the room. Every time I hear Nathan's voice, is it just reminds me of one of the fundamental problems of why America's Cups are won and lost, and that's job protectionism. It's once we've got our feet under the table, are there other people that we could consider for jobs in this team? Yes, possibly we could, but we don't want them making us look bad. And Nathan is a good enough sailor that he should be a pick on any of these teams, I would say. And he would bring value to any of those teams. And I find it incredible that he wasn't picked up by one of the teams as a sailor. But we all benefit from that to get his wonderful insights as a TV commentator.
Yeah, and it really is. I mean, we shouldn't underestimate how much that adds to the whole experience. And you know, Nathan in particular knows when to shut up and listen to the onboard commentary, and I think he really, and you can hear, yeah, he really enjoys listening into it. You know, it's like, because you know, he's been there, he's been on the wheel, he's been the guy with the headset on making those calls. So it's pretty fascinating. But there's that classic curse, isn't there, of the moment that they say, "Oh, let's us shut up and listen to what's going on board the boats," and then they don't say anything for 2 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, well, there is that, but really, I've got very few complaints about the TV coverage. I think it's fantastic.
And from a team point of view, who's impressed you? I know you've not been poring over this massively, but there aren't that many teams anyway, and we've just lost the Americans. Were you surprised the Americans weren't that magic?
It's so difficult to say. From the outside, I mean, that capsize really was the end of them. And I think anyone in that game realized that the big gaping hole that we saw in the bottom of the boat was the most visible problem, but it was probably the most trivial of the problems that they had to address in the 10 days that they had to try and get that boat back up together again. It must have been the complexity of the electronics and getting all that stuff to work again after that massive saltwater ingress that nearly sunk the boat. It looked like they had really difficult problems handling that boat against the Italians for the semi-final. So I don't think we should be that surprised. But I think that what led up to that capsize was brought about through the comms problems at the back of the boat. I think it's really fascinating. One of the most interesting angles of this America's Cup is how they're allocating their limited manpower. And now at the moment, everyone thinks that Ben Ainslie and Giles Scott have got the genius approach of being able to free up Giles, who's an extremely fit guy in his own right, but is freed up to sort of be the Brad Butterworth on that boat and be a pure tactician. But the only reason they can achieve that is they've got such enormous horsepower in the front of that boat. They've probably got the fittest bunch of grinders of any of the teams. So they pretty much give themselves an extra man at the front of the boat because of the engine room they've got there, which frees up Giles to be a better tactician than, say, Terry Hutchinson was able to be because Terry's turning the handles. And I think a lot of this comes back to 2017, when it looked like the geniuses then were the Kiwis, who basically had Pete Burling as the helmsman and tactician. And I remember how ridiculously old school it looked with Tom Slingsby running around the boat for Oracle. It looked so old school then. So, funnily enough, Ben and Giles seem to have gone back to that old school approach of having a pure tactician, and it seems to be working on this kind of racetrack with those kind of decisions to be made.
I think for me, the really interesting thing about that relationship is just that Ben has found somebody that he will take information from and work with in that way, because he really is. I mean, he's like your ultimate single-handed sailor, isn't he? He's self-motivated. He's making the decisions on the boat. He's taking the input from Giles. But I mean, there's not many people, I think, that, well, in fact, I'm not sure who I could imagine would be doing it other than Giles. You've interviewed Ben more than I have, but what do you think?
Well, I think Ben has adapted himself from being a great single-handed sailor with some of the traits of a single-handed sailor that don't always lend themselves to great teamwork. I think Ben has turned himself from a natural single-hander into a great team player. And Giles is also a great single-handed sailor that's adapted to being a great team player, because I don't think those things always go hand in glove. And in the early days of Ben being given the wheel of large keel boats in the Solent, he would often throw the boat around, forgetting the fact that there were 10 or 12 other people that needed to know what was about to happen before he did it. So that didn't always come naturally to Ben, but Ben is one of those people that whatever he needs to do, he will apply himself to the job and make sure that he's up to the task. Because we both know that naturally he's very shy, but he's thrust himself into the limelight for the last 20 years in a way that he's had to overcome that, and he's done that. So I that's what I admire most about Ben, is he's not a natural at everything he does, but he's just more determined to get at least as good as he needs to be for any of the very different tasks that he has as a skipper of an America's Cup team.
He did a great job of standing up and being the front man when the team was at its low point in December. He didn't shy away from any of those press conferences, didn't send anybody else in. And I was pretty impressed with him.
Totally.
I thought that was a great leader's effort. And I interviewed him a little while back, and I asked him about that, and he said, you know, part of his job is to protect, you know, protect the team, protect the people from all of that sort of stuff. And that was the way he was able to do it at that point.
Well, it's sort of a bit like, does your best batsman are they still able to perform as your opening batsman when they become captain of the England cricket team? Because some people rise to that challenge and other people are totally crushed by it. And I have often thought that Ben has put too much on his shoulders, especially for these technical boats. I do believe that the small boat foilers, the Moth World champions like Nathan Outridge and Pete Burling, have an automatic advantage over those that haven't come through that sort of, you know, foiling go-kart sort of background. And Ben's proving me wrong. You know, he looks like he's every bit good enough to get these boats around the track extremely quickly. But I've often wondered whether he lacks that in his background of not having done that sort of really, you know, 11-foot foiling where everything is so instant and the feedback is so obvious that you get into an AC-75 and everything's sort of happening in bullet time.
Yeah, I saw a great email from the Finn class, who were bigging up the British performance, and of course putting it all down to the fact that Giles and Ben are Finn sailors, and then listing all of the other Finn sailors that are in the America's Cup. And clearly the only way to be an America's Cup sailor these days is to be a Finn sailor.
Well, I would be making the most of that as well. And no, I mean, the Finn can rightly claim a lot of credit for great America's Cup sailors over the years. And I thought maybe their day was passed at the back of, certainly in the afterguard of these boats, once they got hopped onto foils, but it appears not to be the case.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Just a quick word, Andy, about the push me, pull you approach of the Italians to helmsmen. I remember hearing about this when I was doing some work with Corps 36, the Challenger of Record organization that was there to organize the America's Cup World Series events, which of course never happened. But I was based in Cagliari, right next door to the Luna Rossa base, and I heard this, that, you know, the guys were going to have a helmsman on either side and basically two sets of, you know, a team down either side. And at the time I was like, wow, that's incredible. It doesn't look too bad though, does it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't look too bad. You don't have anyone running round the back of the mainsail, which looks pretty precarious at times. And are we going to lose anyone over the back of the boat while they run round the back?
Oh yeah, for sure. Actually, the Italians have started doing that. They've been sending Pietro Sabello to the back, and he's been actually spending a bit of time back there to get his 360 degree view of the race. When I say quite a bit of time, it's like 5 seconds as he clings onto those handles and tries not to be shaken off by the main sheet trimmer. Yeah, so it's they have adapted that style a little bit, maybe to counter what Giles and Ben have got going on. But do you see it working in the long term?
I'm not sure that we got the long term to actually find out, really. It's all going to be over extremely quickly. I'm quite sceptical about it. I don't think we really learnt that much more about them from that perspective in the races against America, because they weren't that tested. So they are where they are. They've got to carry on down that road, and clearly it does have its advantages. I feel like it brings issues of where the chain of command is. That's an issue that I have, and I think that was highlighted in some of the races against the Brits, where there's a much clearer hierarchy and a much clearer line of communication going on in the British boat. But anyway, they will be working on that. They've got a lot of people who are prepared to be honest and frank about improving themselves. I think Jimmy Spithill is an important addition to that team. Obviously, he's worked for Luna Rossa before as well. I'm really impressed with them. I tend to think that strongly Italian teams are going to be their own undoing. I think the sort of nationalistic approach is not one that you see, for example, in top-end football. You don't try and play football with one leg tied behind your back and try and play the Premiership with England-only players. You pick from the best in the world. And obviously there are limitations on what you can do within the rules with the America's Cup. But I've been really impressed with how self-contained and how measured the Italians have been, and also how ruthless they've been as well with how they're prepared to clutch at anything to throw the rule book at their rivals.
Yeah, I think so. And just a word about Jimmy. I mean, it was clear right from the beginning that they weren't going to have it as the Jimmy Spithill show. This was an Italian team, a very, very Italian team with a very Italian sponsor. In fact, two very Italian sponsors. And, you know, Jimmy was pretty limited in what he was allowed to do in the media, or they permitted him to do in the media. We've seen more of him since he's got to Auckland and the racing has started. But I honestly think part of this dual helmsman role was just so that it wasn't an Italian boat that wasn't really an Italian boat, because it had an Australian helmsman. So having Francesco Bruni there to split the helming role just keeps it Italian. That's my view from what I saw.
Yeah, and every time you make one of those decisions, because you're doing it for the reasons of patriotism and pride, are you doing it for the right reasons in terms of being able to win the America's Cup? That would be my question. Yeah. But this is, I would say, the most credible Italian challenge that I can remember. I think they look like the real deal. And what an amazing scenario to have seen the boats race this much against each other as we have, and I still wouldn't be able to pick the eventual winner of the America's Cup.
Well, that's right. Or indeed the Prada Cup, which is coming up. I think it's way too close to call. My hope is that we get great racing like we saw the other day. My fervent hope is that isn't the best race we've seen in this America's Cup cycle. And because my honest opinion is that the Kiwis are several clicks ahead of anything the Challenger teams have got. I honestly think whoever gets through to that final is going to have a torrid time in the match against Emirates Team New Zealand.
Well, Emirates Team New Zealand don't have the benefit of being able to race another boat, but apparently Ray Davies is the other boat in their chase boat. So he's the one that brings the match racing to Pete Burling and the guys on the actual AC75 itself. So they're sort of doing mock races, but they must have an incredibly good gauge of their performance relative to the boats that they've seen racing around the racetrack during the Prada Cup. I'm sure they're all over that. So I'm sure they know where they're at. And as you know, I've been speaking to Hamish Wilcox an awful lot over the last number of months, and he says that their focus is actually going to be mostly on boat handling and manoeuvres more than actual out-and-out speed in the final run into the cup. So that I think is fascinating, that the old Brad Butterworth saying, and I'm sure he wasn't the first, was that in the America's Cup, fastest boat always wins. I think we saw, for example, the other day, Ineos Team UK in that amazing race against Luna Rossa. Sometimes the better sailed boat on this racetrack in these boats can actually win. And they were sailing with that Cunningham jammed on, and they looked a little bit inhibited downwind, having to sail bigger angles, and they still managed to eke out that win. So I think we're seeing a more balanced America's Cup where, yes, it's still obviously a design race, but there's a huge amount of sailing that goes into these boats as well.
So, Andy, perhaps one of the reasons that you haven't been staying up all night to watch the America's Cup live, and you haven't been as fully tuned into the Vendée Globe as you might have been normally as a sailing journalist, is that you have just successfully launched an amazing new product. Perhaps you could give us the 1 minute elevator pitch.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So, Road to Gold is a 12-step course in how to put together a world-class sailing program. And so the person that I've been working with on this, Hamish Wilcox, he, back in the day, in the 1980s, he and David Barnes burst onto the Olympic sailing scene, and they won 3 470 world titles in the space of 4 years. And Hamish was just 19 years old. His first trip overseas as an Olympic sailor, his first event was the World Championships. And he and David Barnes win the world championship at their very first attempt. And that was when the 470 was even harder than it is today, because there wasn't so much choice of Olympic class. Anyway, Hamish was meant to go to those Olympic Games, and then David and Hamish didn't actually win those Kiwi trials to the great shock of people all around the world. But Hamish has gone on to become a coach to so many people that have gone on to win Olympic medals and America's Cups. And for the last 8 years, he's been working as coach to Pete Burling and Blair Chute. Yeah, so basically, Hamish has worked with probably two of the biggest names in the sailing world over the last 8 years. And so I think there are a number of reasons why people are interested in getting on their own Road to Gold and buying the 12-module course. We've had a lot of Olympic sailors, including reigning Olympic champions and reigning world champions, get on the course because I think they want an insight into how that trio, that sort of that setup works between Hamish and Pete Burling and Blair Tuke, who have been so successful in the 49er over the last nearly best part of a decade. And obviously Pete and Blair have also won the America's Cup and come very close to winning the Volvo Ocean Race. So it's partly an insight into how those guys go about getting as good as they need to get in every aspect of their campaign. So there's an awful lot more I could say, but where do you want me to take you next on it, Justin?
Well, I just want to check a few things. So we're calling it Road to Gold, which would kind of suggest it's about Olympic sailing, but that's not the intention, is it? It really is for anybody who just wants to ramp up the professionalism of their approach to their campaign. And as you said, you've had a lot of people who are, I mean, tell me about the range of people from, as you say, you know, world champions and Olympic campaigners, but many more besides.
Yeah, so as you say, Road to Gold does imply that it's Olympic focused, and certainly a lot of the sort of the case studies in Road to Gold are 470 or 49er focused, but we also have a lot of keelboat races in there that have jumped on the campaign, and catamaran races, and even windsurfers and kite surfers, because fundamentally this is about how to put a winning campaign together. And it's shines a light on those sometimes bright, shiny objects that might be the right thing for Pete Burling and Blair Chute to buy for where they're at in their campaign, but it might not be right for you and where you're at on your campaign. So to give you an example that I hear all the time, when I travel to Olympic events and I sit down in the evening with a coach, and the coach is being employed for somewhere close to €1,000 a day, plus accommodation, plus travel, plus rib hire. It's an enormous amount of money per day. And I hear these coaches say, yes, I'm just working with this new 49er FX team, but you know what? They can't even bear the boat away. They can't drive without capsizing. So we decided after day one of keel week that we'd go out for day two and just watch the top 10 go around the Woodman Bar. And then in the evening, we sit down and we watch YouTube videos. So they're paying somebody close to €1,500 a day to watch YouTube videos and learn the basics of how to sail their boat around the track. So to Hamish, that is the complete arse about face, opposite way round to go about putting a winning Olympic campaign together. His view is that he won't take anyone on the road from New Zealand to compete on the European circuit until they're capable of getting a top 10 in the world championships in their class. And to give you an example, the 2013 World Championships, the 49er World Championships in Marseille. At that point, Pete and Blair hadn't won a world championship. They won silver medal at the London 2012 Games the year before. But also working with Hamish that week were Marcus Hansen and Josh Perebski, who were doing their first world championship. And so we had two boats sitting on either side of his rib going into the final medal race. There were only two boats in it that could win the world championships at that point, and they were both sitting either side of Hamish. So Marcus asked Hamish, what do I do in this last race? He said, well, the only thing you can do is go and win. And Pete and Blair are looking at Hamish and saying, well, what does that mean for us? And he said, well, you've got to go and win too. Anyway, so Pete and Blair do end up winning the last race. They win their first ever 49er world championship, but Marcus and Josh, the greenhorns that have never done a 49er world championship, end up coming second to Pete and Blair. And so Hamish's view that goes all the way back to 1981, to when he was 19 years old, and this was partly because they were strapped for cash and he was painting people's houses during the day so he could get a couple of hours sailing in with Dave Barnes in the evening. They got world-class good at boat handling. They sorted so much of their boat speed out just by themselves before they even found a training partner to line up against. But fundamentally, Hamish is totally opposed to people who want to spend 10 years working their apprenticeship on the international circuit, working their way up through the back of bronze fleet, maybe in year two or three getting into silver fleet, and maybe 8 years down the road when you're getting close to retirement, you might just be breaking into the gold fleet and possibly have a chance of getting on the podium. To him, that's all the wrong way around. And Road to Gold is about setting your priorities and giving you a clear focus for where you need to be working at, depending on where you're at on your campaign.
Now, Andy, I know this has been extremely well received. It's so different. I mean, there hasn't been anything like this before. The membership course approach is used greatly around the world for other topics, but nobody's done this with sailing before. So I wondered where did it come from? Was this you driving it, or Hamish driving it, or was it a conversation over beers somewhere that evolved into this?
It all came about from an interview that Seahorse asked me to do with Hamish back in May or June 2020, and I'd met Hamish a couple of times on the circuit, but I'd never really had a proper chat with him. And we did this interview, and at the end I said, I used to read your stuff avidly in Yachts and Yachting magazine when I was in short trousers and reading about you winning 470 world titles. And I remember this 2,000 hours thing that you wrote once. And I said, what was that about? And he said, oh, that was from my book that I wrote called Winning in 470s. And I was thinking, well, I spent 5 or 6 years trying to win in 470s. I never heard of that book before. Anyway, that's because it was published in Japanese. Oh, right, okay. So he wrote a book, and it sold out. 10,000 copies of the book sold out in the Japanese language alone, and that was partly because Hamish was brought in as the coach to the Japanese 470 setup, which culminated in the Japanese winning the world championships in the late 80s, actually. And his whole approach, this structured approach that forms the Road to Gold, originally came about through his connections with Japan and the fact there was a language barrier and that he needed to pass across this information as clearly as he could. So he ended up writing this book, published in Japanese, and he said to me at the end of this Seahorse interview, I've been thinking about writing an English version of this book for the last 30 years, but I just haven't got around to it. And maybe, you know, COVID would be the time to do it. I said, I'd love to help you with that. But have you thought about doing it as an online course instead? So anyway, that's where it ended up becoming an online course. And it seemed like the natural thing to do rather than a book, because it gives us this possibility of interaction with the people who are going along on the course. And every Saturday evening, it is at the moment, because that's the only day off. Sunday morning it is for Hamish in New Zealand. That's his only day off from working for Emirates Team New Zealand on the America's Cup. We have a phone in on Zoom, and people can throw their questions at us on any of the 12 different modules of Road to Gold, wherever they're at on their own personal Road to Gold. And we have people from every part of the sport, from club racers that just want to get better and are just fascinated about the process behind how you improve yourself, to people like Santiago Langer and Lily Zhu, double 470 world champion Nick Asher. But Santi Langer, he gave us some fantastic insights, some of which you're going to have to sign up to on the Road to Gold to actually hear them. But one of the things he said to us was, I wish you guys hadn't put out this course because all that COVID wasn't happening, because it means that everyone's actually doing what they should have been doing, which is actually doing some proper training by themselves or maybe with their training partner, rather than racing around the world from one regatta to the next and never really getting any better as they go. So that hit it right between the eyes for us. That is totally the Hamish message, that is that, yeah, I mean, of course you can have fun traveling around the world, but if you really want to get better traveling around the world, the racing that you do at Kiel Week or your world championships is the icing on the cake. It's not your bread and butter. It is the last, it's the top of the apex of the pyramid. All the hard work at the base of the pyramid is what you do with your boat handling practice and your two boat tuning and all of that.
Yeah, and I guess the kind of point here is that it's great to travel around Europe for the summer, but there's no point in going to all these regattas if you can't get downwind in 20 knots and, you know, you're swimming your way around the course. Better to stay at home and learn how to do that in a controlled environment before you go racing.
It's such an obvious point, and obviously people love their racing. It's why a lot of us go sailing. We think of training as dull, but I think the other thing is that Hamish brings a lot of fun to the whole process, and he says, and it's another obvious point once you hear it, is that you're not going to succeed if you're not having fun. It's a long, hard road to get to the top of any sport. And so you've got to make the process enjoyable. You've got to mix it up. You've always got to be finding ways of surprising yourself. And you've got to work with a tight team. And if you think you're going to get there on your own as you know, one single-handed sailor or 149er or 470 team, you're not going to get there, because those that pull their resources are going to get past you, because they're going to get much quicker, much more efficient answers to the same problems that you're trying to solve. So don't try and be selfish. Find your tight-knit group and share that knowledge between the group. And the best example I can think of, there are many good ones, but I really admire what Pavlos Kontides from Cyprus has achieved, along with people like Tonči Stepanović from Croatia. These poor nations, or certainly not first world top-end sailing nations, they work together, and Pavlos has won an Olympic silver medal and two world championships in the laser, and Tonči Stepanović was the first ever Olympic medalist from Croatia, winning the silver in Rio. So you do see that when people put aside their rivalries and actually work together as a unit, you can achieve incredible things.
Another great example of that, Elliot Hansen, who we had on the podcast just before Christmas. You know, he's part of the British laser squad. He's got the berth now to go to the Tokyo Games. But that squad they adopted exactly that approach and ended up with filling the podium at the last Laser Europeans. And he said that was, you know, a complete vindication of their approach of, yes, we're competitors, but we know that if we work together, we're all going to get better and better and better. And I guess that kind of ties in with the themes behind Road to Gold.
Perfect example and absolutely incredible, and also a big reason why the Finns in GBR have done so well over the last 20 years, that pooling of resources and knowledge, and also why the top two Finn sailors in New Zealand have done so well over the last few years, Andy Maloney and Josh Jr. working so closely together, and Josh Jr. winning the Finn Gold Cup a year or so back.
It's not all about working with your mates. There's some really interesting insights that are thought-provoking and kind of counterintuitive. And we had a chat about it when you were launching the program. And the one that stuck in my mind was this idea of when you know, I guess the perceived wisdom is, you know, be a little bit conservative, don't bang the corners, that sort of stuff. But sometimes at certain venues, when you know there's a persistent feature like a wind bend or whatever, sometimes banging the corner is the conservative thing to do.
That was a massive reveal to me. And again, it just sounds so obvious, because instinctively as a sailor, you've known when there are times when it felt really good to go into the corner, but you sort of feel in the background guilty about going there because the textbooks that you've read, or maybe the coaching that you've had, that said, oh, you've got to be careful about straying from the middle of the course. And there are some fantastic sailors that do really well from the middle of the course, like Matt Belcher and Will Ryan, that have a slight boat speed advantage in the 470 that allows them to hedge their bets. But Hamish still thinks that even someone like Matt Belcher is leaving money on the table. And in fact, one of the things that led Pete Burling and Blair Tuke to Hamish was his decision-making skills, because bear in mind, Burling and Tuke had already won silver medal at London 2012. They were already world-class, and their boat handling and their boat speed was already world-class, but they didn't really always know why they should be going one side of the course or the other. And then that World Championships I mentioned in earlier about Marseille in 2013, that was a classic case where they did their homework. Hamish, by the way, went on from being a great athlete around a 470 to becoming a wind spotter for America's Cup teams, and then developed further into becoming a weather expert, and over what's now five America's Cup cycles that he's worked on. So he has become one of the preeminent weather experts at the top end of sailing. And he applies that knowledge, looks at the synoptic charts, looks at the different weather models, compares them, asks the locals, always goes to the local sailors or the local fishermen and asks them what they know, puts together this strategy for this is the way that you should go, guys. I've got a 90% certainty that you should hit left when the wind is this angle in Marseille. And that was part of the reason why they were able to finish first and second in the Kiwi squad at those World Championships, was they were really confident about the left-hand side. And as long as you got a good start and were able to hold your lane hard into the left-hand side of the race course, that was going to be a winning strategy in Marseille. So there's a concrete example of this sort of decision-making that Hamish also brings to the game.
What I like about this, Andy, is that it's very structured. And I did see, or maybe I heard you on one of the calls say, you know, don't binge watch this, don't Netflix this, you know, try and stick to it being a structured course, because there's a huge, huge amount of information that you could just get engulfed by, couldn't you? If you try and just do it all in one go.
Yeah, that is right. And I think when we have got to the end of version one, because we're pushing it out chapter by chapter at the moment, and then version one will sit up there for the best part of a year before we come back and do an enhanced version two. And we always ask our users, our Road to Goldsters, how it's going for them, not only in terms of the technical stuff that they're learning about the actual sailing, but also the learning process. And we're getting feedback on that, and we're taking that feedback, and that will be incorporated into the different ways that we produce the information in the future. So, for example, we've got a lot of sailors who for whom English is not their first language. So we've got subtitles running, or sort of an auto transcript that runs on the videos. That is not perfect because it's automatically generated, but it's certainly helping people out. So when we get requests like that saying, "Oh, I'm not quite hearing what Hamish says," we either answer them directly, or we use automation tools to help us with that. But yes, there are visual learners, there are audio learners, there are people that learn by reading. We've all got different learning styles, and so we're trying to address that as best as we can. But yes, the most important thing is to keep on moving through the Road to Gold. Try and give it at least an hour a week, ideally 2 hours a week, and keep on working your way through the Road to Gold, because it's a lot of fun to do it. And I think maybe one of the other things is it's a conversation between me and Hamish. It's not a monologue. It's me as a reasonably good sailor asking Hamish, hopefully, some of the questions that other people on the call or you know, following along would also do. So it's hopefully not too high end. It is pretty high end, but the overall structure of Road to Gold really will work for anybody that wants to improve their sailing at any level of the sport.
And you're partway through the release of this first 12-week course, but if people want to join now, they can just start from week one. They don't have to wait until week 12 or whenever the course kind of resets. So the course is open and live right now, yeah?
Yes, it's just that there's an enormous amount to produce in terms of the content and how we slice and dice it. So it's the fact that I've got a small team working on this, and we can only work at such a speed. Otherwise, we'd have put it all out in one go. But it's been quite nice launching it chapter by chapter, as we have done, because the Road to Goldsters that have been following it closely. We've got a bit of a family feel to that now. Some people that I've got to know extremely well from around the world that have been following the course and looking to apply it to their J70 sailing or their 2.4 meter sailing or whatever it is. And they've been massively helpful in terms of giving us feedback about what it's like to be one of the early guinea pigs on Road to Gold, because we're going to be around for a long time. It's working out very nicely for us at the moment, but what we really want to do, Hamish and I, is get that knowledge out to a much broader group of sailors around the world. And for example, there was a 49er FX sailor in India who, in the whole of India with a billion people, can't find somebody else to do a 49er FX campaign with. And she'd pretty much given up on her sailing ambitions, having won medals at the Asian Games. And she read some of the promotional material for Road to Gold, and she was so excited and re-energized about getting involved in her sailing again that she bought Road to Gold, and it's given her that impetus to go out and find that other person that she can do a 49er FX campaign with in India. And so we're really excited about anyone who's excited about Road to Gold, but we're particularly excited about reaching the emerging nations and sharing that high-level, world-class information that's worked so well for Burling and Chuuk, and spreading that information as far as possible across the world.
And you guys have got some great endorsements. Pete and Blair give it the thumbs up, obviously. I guess they can hardly not do, given that it's produced by the coach that's helped them with so much of the success. But I see Russell Coutts is on there as somebody endorsing it as well. Give us just a taste of the first kind of chapter headings for the weeks that have gone out so far, because I think this gives people a bit of an insight into what this course is all about.
The first chapter one is the beginning, and it's getting to ask yourself some hard questions about: are you going in the right direction? Are you sailing the right boat for you? Are you sailing with the right person for you? Is there mutual respect within the team? Are you doing the right job within the boat? And so asking some of those fundamentals, and then making sure that you buy your equipment wisely. There's a fantastic example of Carl Evans and Pete Burling actually did the 2008 games in the 470 for New Zealand. And Pete Burling was only 17 at the time when he was crewing in the 470 doing his first Olympics. Anyway, they did okay. I can't remember where they finished, maybe just inside the top 10. Not bad when you're 17 years old. He then got out, was going to do the 49er as he went on to do. So they sold that boat to Joe Alley and Polly Parry. And Joe Alley was early into the 470 then, didn't know one end of the boat from the other, decided she was going to stick with that equipment. And she did all the way through that Olympic cycle, didn't change anything. Same gear as the boys used for 2008, ended up winning the gold medal at London 2012. So the message there was, depending on where you are on your Olympic campaign or maybe your campaign for any other class in the world, unless you really know what you're doing, are you sure you should be buying something brand new and putting it all together yourself? Or should you buy something that's proven and already won races? And that's how I buy my Musto skiffs. I can't be bothered trying to fit it out myself. Not that there's an awful lot to do on a simple boat like that, but I'd rather buy something that's ready spliced and pre-tuned by someone who's already won the national championships or the world championships. And so sorry, only on chapter one. I better race through a bit, hadn't I? chapter two is fitness. Hamish is nearly 60 years old, and he still is the same shape as when he was winning 470 world championships 30 years ago. There are a couple of secret messages in there that Burling and Chute didn't really want to get out about, partly why they have become as good as they did in the 49er, but that's in the fitness chapter. Then it goes, chapter three is boat handling. Chapter four is best speed. That's your VMG that you can achieve through the water without any other boats around you, working on your boat speed. Before you get into the second part of boat speed, which is race speed, now you train with your group in two-boat or three-boat training lineups and see if you can hold your own as piggy in the middle between the two boats either side of you. And so we're still nowhere near close to racing yet, but the next chapter is starting, and then we work on starting drills, slow boat handling drills, and you start to identify different day types. What kind of day is it going to be today? Is it a steady wind day? Is it shifty day? Is one side of the course favored? This is going to influence the kind of approach to the start that you make. Again, sounds really obvious, but most people don't do it, even at Olympic level. A lot of us, you and I, I'm sure, Justin, have our favorite kind of start, and it's a square peg that sometimes has a square hole to fit into on the right day, and other days we'll try and make that square peg fit into a round hole. And
that's very true.
I've done a lot of Olympic commentary, and I see some of the best in the world use the same approach to the start every race that they do, and sometimes it works and sometimes it goes terribly, terribly wrong. So we address the fundamentals of, why do you only start that way? Why don't you think about starting a different way? And why don't you learn the skills to be able to do that? And then we go from starting into tactics, the boat on boat stuff. Then we go into strategy. This is where we're in the decision-making part of Road to Gold, of looking at synoptic weather charts, learning about them, learning about the weather models, studying tide data, studying even wave speed and wave period. Surfers will know what I'm talking about. This was new to me because I don't surf, so I've been learning there about wave speed and wave period. Then we get to the weather itself. That has its own chapter. And then next week we're getting on to mental strength before we get into planning. And then final chapter, number 12, is racing. Finally, we get to go racing. But that's the top of the pyramid. It's not the bottom.
Yeah. I'm sitting here listening to all of that and hearing some of those insights and thinking, this almost feels a little bit unfair, really.
it is an unfair advantage. If you take it and apply it, then you will get better. You cannot help but get better if you go through this. And again, Santiago Langer, I asked him, why are you here, Santi? You know, if we can teach you anything here, we really have done our job. And he said, it's about finding new ways of doing the same thing, and it's about keeping your head in the game. And for the COVID period that we're in, and with the Olympic sailors not even knowing if they're going to get a race in before they go to the Olympics, if the Olympics happens at all, they better make sure that they're race ready as they can be when they hit the start line. And for Santi down in Argentina with no other boats to train with right now, it's keeping his head in the game. That's why he's on the road to gold. And I think if it's good enough for him, it's probably good enough for both, for most of us.
I would say so. We've talked about what it is. Tell us how much it costs.
It costs $249 US for the basic course. If you just want the basics, which is all you need, but if you also want to get on the live calls and get the recordings of the live calls, which take place for an hour every Saturday evening in Europe, Sunday morning in Australasia, then it's another $50. So it's $299, and that is the as they always say, that's the best price. You know, that's the one that I advise you that you buy for the extra $50, which is not an awful lot. You get access to be able to ask Hamish questions directly, and to also hear how other people are using and learning from the way that they're using Road to Gold.
Yeah, I can't think of an immediate comparison to what costs that on any sort of campaign. But
well, let me come back to the cost of hiring a coach for the day, especially one of the caliber of Hamish. It's in the order of $1,000 a day for a high end coach at Olympic level, and that's before you take into account the travel, the rib, the accommodation, all the rest of it. So for anyone spending the kind of money they do on an Olympic campaign, then it should be a no-brainer. And it's also tax expensible as well. So we can send you an invoice if you need it to send to your accountant. But yes, you think about a jib, you know, any jib for any small boat, even a 420 is probably going to cost you at least $300 US, if not a little bit more. And one windy day and that jib could be blown out, and then it gets turned into a sail bag if it's lucky to have a second life at all. What you learn on Road to Gold, you will take with you for the rest of your sailing career.
That's fantastic. Andy, I'm going to be helping you promote this via the podcast and also by the Yacht Racing Life website. So let's give people a link that they can get to your website and find out more about it and hopefully sign up. So that's goroadforgold.net/yachtracinglife. And we'll stick this in as many places as we can in the show notes and all that sort of good stuff. Andy, we've broken our golden rule. We're over an hour of talking to each other, and we always say an hour's probably enough of us. It's been fascinating to hear all about Road to Gold. It's great to catch up with you and have a chat through like we used to do in the old days. Thanks for taking the time to do it. And let's do it again soon, maybe after the America's Cup's over.
I would love to do that, Justin. I always love having a chat with you. I can't believe this is called work. But anyway, aren't we lucky? And really, really good to catch up with you, mate.